is not wrong when she describes this moment with words that, almost 5 decades before, accompanied the steps of the first man on the moon. It was a small step, albeit a brave one, for a man to mount a horse. The comparison with the moon landing is certainly not exaggerated. The moment when man began, by domestication and breeding, to connect his fate with the horse, not with a nutritional intention, but with a vectorial aim, may have been, before the invention of writing, the narrow gate through which man entered the realm of history. Tough grass. With the horse, man not only had a particularly fast and agile companion, whose strength, endurance, and speed gave him new, unheard-of means to wage war and engage in macro-politics. The horse was also a comparatively undemanding and robust partner that was almost as adaptable as man himself. This is particularly the case with respect to the horse's nutritional needs and digestive system. Horses feed on grass that no cattle would be able to eat. Its cellulose structure is too tough, and because of its low protein content, it offers insufficient nutrition for cows and most even-toed ungulates. Moreover, ruminants, such as cows, need long rest periods to chew the cud, while a horse, with its simple stomach, can digest as it carries on walking. But the primary precondition for the horse's resilience and frugal nutritional needs is, of course, its pearly whites. Thanks to their particularly high and hard-crowned teeth, horses can graze on and break down the tough grass of the prairies, steppes, and savanna with its high proportion of silicon in the cell walls. As teeth evolved in the horse's precursors, these early animals would have become able to move away from softer leafy fare and exchange their former habitat, the forest, for the steppe. In order to provide sufficient nutrition, this new, less protein-rich feed needed to be consumed in larger quantities. This, in turn, required the newcomers to the steppes and the semi-arid zones to roam freely, covering large ranges and living in small groups. It was this combination of circumstances, physical constitution and lifestyle, which made the horse the ideal partner for man, who longed to expand the radius of his sphere of life and of influence. In addition to these attributes, there was the inherent domesticability of the horse, or of specific types of proto-horse, including perhaps Przewalski's horse, although not the tarpan, an extinct subspecies of wild horse. Once broken out of its wild state, the horse proved to be a reliable and sensitive companion for man. While the philosophy of history and the theory of power in the schools of Nietzsche and Spengler directed their macro-historical focus solely on the effect of speed and its impact, war, macro-politics, historical ecology has focused more closely on the processes that played out between animals and their environment, and the significant consequences on the energy balance. The horse, writes Jürgen Osterhammer, in the context of the 19th century North American Wild West, functioned as an energy transformer, converting the energy stored in grassland into muscle power obedient to human command. Indeed, not only the North American prairies, but all large grassland and semi-arid areas of the world represented gigantic energy stores that could be put to use by domesticable animals such as horses. These animals were capable of taking in the potential energy of the steppe grasses and transforming it into kinetic energy, which could be used for a range of purposes, from war to buffalo hunting. This theory of the animal organism as an energy transformer, as Osterhammer puts it, or converter, the term used in English, harks back to the engineers and physicists of the late 19th century, who, in an effort to increase the energy efficiency of machines, studied the animal as a living combustion engine. Robert Henry Thurston should certainly be mentioned in this context, whose reflections also reached a German readership thanks to the translation by German mechanical engineer Franz Rollo. The transfer of this energy into historical human societies was the focus of the work of Chicago sociologist Fred Cottrell. According to him, the first and most important converter is man himself, because of his inventiveness. Man understands how to harness the different types of potential energy and put them to use. But man, says Cottrell, also makes use of converters other than his own body to achieve his ends, and the energy these converters make available to him is also measurable. Thus, wherever other converters can be used to replace or supplement the energies of man, the relative advantage in energy terms of using them over using his own physical effort can be calculated. The horse's metabolism enables the transformation or conversion of energy. It absorbs the energy stored in plants and converts it into energy that can be exploited as kinetic energy for moving, pulling, and carrying. This assumes, of course, that the conversion of plant matter into the horse's flesh is used not just once, that is, when it is eaten, but that the horse is recognized and exploited as a sustainable, renewable producer of kinetic energy. The tack and riding equipment used, reins, saddles, spurs, etc., harness the energy derived through this conversion process and steer it in the direction desired by the respective historical group. Man is also a converter, as Cottrell demonstrates, and a particularly sophisticated one at that. He has learnt to make use of other energy converters and to harness them for his own purposes. This harnessing is to be understood in both a literal and in a more comprehensive way. Man expands his range not only by harnessing the power of his own muscles, but by exploiting other converters to his own advantage, initially only as supplies of food, but later, at a higher stage of development, as vectors, that is, suppliers of kinetic energy. The domestication of draft animals greatly increases the mechanical energy available to those who possess them. A historical ecology, seen in this way, involves various actors from animals, plants, microbes, viruses, through to technology, water, and wind, not to mention the dust and sand that clog up the gears. Since we live in enlightened times, we can round off the list without including ghosts, devils, and assorted otherworldly fauna, but we can't escape natural disasters. Of course, people are also subjects of their own historical ecology, but that seems to play a lesser role here than in classical political history, because they are now perceived more and more in connection with and in contrast to natural processes. The further we move into the 21st century, the more clearly we see what is at the heart of an historical ecology, the history of energy, the transformation of its forms and its carriers, the challenge of its distribution. It is true that in the foreseeable future, the core of the narrative is still dominated by the ensemble of political ideas and actions, war and peace, law, administration, and the realm of freedom. But all political attitudes, actions, and concepts will in future be re-examined and re-evaluated in the light of the balance of energies. In contrast to the concept of history that came before, this history of energy no longer divides the historical world into two separate halves, human and non-human history. And it is in the horse that this history of energy has one of its most significant index fossils. Conquest. Becoming an Indian. When the comedian Myron Cohen delivered his stand-up act on the club circuit of North America in the 1950s and 1960s, his repertoire included several jokes with an unmistakable foreign flavor. Some gags were immigrants from Italy, others came from Ireland or Poland, while most were of Jewish origin. But even Cohen's apparently indigenous American numbers wavered somewhere between cultures. Among them was the one about the man who was driving in the wrong direction down a one-way street and was stopped by a police officer. The officer asks, "Didn't you see the arrow?" The man replies, "What? I didn't even see the Indian." Cohen's joke is distinguished not only by its brevity, but also by its universality. Someone from Austria or China can laugh at it as much as an American. Perhaps the Americans were tickled most of all by it, because the confusion between the two kinds of arrow amounts to a reversal of two centuries of American culture and way of life. In other words, for Americans, the joke is not just a matter of semiotics, it's also about history. From the world of cars and arrow-shaped graphics on road signs, the quip takes us back to the world of mounted natives and their arrows, too quick to see. However, this alliance between horses and the arrow is anything but a purely American invention. First forged by the Asiatic nomads, the residents of the steppes, it was later reinforced by Arab horsemen. "The arrow," wrote Elias Canetti, "was the Mongols' main weapon. They killed from a distance, and they also killed while moving, from the backs of their horses. The American popular imagination, of course, only pictures the Native Americans. That's the direction they look, historically, down the cultural one-way street. The connection between horses and bows and arrows is, in this respect, real in nature. It is historic, if by history we imagine events that actually took place and things that actually existed. But we also know there to exist, besides these things, and in the folds between them, many other connections between horse and arrow, conjectures and conjunctures that are formed in the realm of the imagination. Why should they be any less real than the things made of wood, iron, flesh, and blood? Ideas are also facts, as Jacob Burckhardt put it. In Cohen's joke, we see two images in close contact, a glimpse of a horse and one of an arrow, two indicators of fast motion in space. The fleet-footed animal combines with the speeding projectile, the technical object, the man-made artifact, as too is the domesticated horse. The Native American, in turn, is their liaison officer, the point of contact between the two. He is horseman and arrowman in one form. Master of two types of speed, the animal speed of the horse and the technical velocity of the arrow. He is the agent who coordinates their interaction, steering and adding, the helmsman who brings the two parts together. He is the arrownaut in the airspace over the prairie. In a short piece of flash fiction, As Fast as the Wind, consisting of one single sentence with the title, Longing to be a Red Indian, Franz Kafka portrays in staccato, lightning-quick bolts of consecutive phrases, a complete metamorphosis from rider to arrow, or perhaps to a simple, matterless rushing motion. Oh, to be a red Indian, instantly prepared and astride one's galloping mount, leaning into the wind, to skim with each fleeting, quivering touch over the quivering ground, till one shed the spurs, for there were no spurs, till one flung off the reins, for there were no reins, and could barely see the land unfurl as a smooth, shorn heath before one, now that horse's neck and horse's head were gone. Taking a closer look, we see what is actually happening in the Indian's ride or dream ride. It's a single, breathless process of dropping and discarding, throwing off reins, spurs, and tack, a process that devours even the horse in the end. Nothing remains of the rushing ensemble as the rider leans into the wind, and eventually nothing remains of him besides his perspective and a quivering and a dashing motion that sends this perspective racing over the smooth shorn heath into the void. And then it is the sentence itself, this single sentence that flies on over the horse's head like the vista opening up or like a bolt of lightning while the reader is carried away by the dynamic momentum, hurtling over something bald or closely shaved like the bare heath. Or it could be the prairie. And as the sentence dismantles everything, discarding whatever comes to hand, spurs, reins, the horse's neck and head, it calls up other ideas and images, forcing the reader's imagination to finish saying what it, the galloping sentence, needs not say explicitly. It is in the double beat of homonyms, or repeated phrases, words and syllables, quivering, quivering, till, till, for, for, horse's neck, horse's head, that we hear the clip-clopping of galloping hooves. It is with the replacement of the expected subjunctive verb by the indicative imperfect, there were no, that we feel the quivering, shaken-up structure of the sentence. It finds no syntactic completion, but is left dangling, giving readers the impression that they are there on the back of the horse, clinging on behind the author, peering over his shoulder, or even that the readers are alone on the horse, that they are themselves, the rider, being shaken and jolted so that they can barely hear or see. And the reader becomes this arrow of pure kinetic energy, hurtling west in the direction of the marching American frontier, the same direction underlying Kafka's novel America, which begins on the East Coast and moves ever westward to Oklahoma. With a single, relatively short sentence construction, which is grammatically and syntactically defunct, and threatens at every moment to disintegrate into its component parts like a stagecoach ransacked and ravaged, Kafka conveys the essence of a narrative that unfurls in the mind of the reader, a story that plays with a stock of cultural images the author knew he could rely on, cowboys, Indians, horses, Riders, the Prairie, the Wild West. Just as Myron Cohen could be sure that his audience was familiar with a one-way street, a car, a driver, a policeman, an arrow, and a road sign. The sentence plays with what Flaubert calls idées reçues, received ideas, commonly held conceptions, common goods, shared by every reader participating in the wordplay of his time. Except, here it is perhaps objets reçus, shared objects, the semantics and usage of which are familiar to everyone. It is only on the surface level that it appears Kafka has written a passage of 61 words, 71 in Malcolm Pasley's English translation, 10 commas and one full stop on white paper, perhaps yellowing with the passage of time. In fact, what he has written in this text, which is incomparably expansive and diffuse, is the sediment of cultural vestiges, the particles of dust kicked up by the hoofbeats of the prose, the soil in which we etch out our last will and testament. The soldier marking his dying wishes in the sand, as described by the German lexicographer Johann Heinrich Zedler. In other words, as they read, readers experience Kafka's sentence decomposing over the quivering ground, disintegrating into its component parts, not building or welling up into a narrative whole, but, on the contrary, crumbling into one. Kafka's sentence is like the beginning of a firework display, sparks bursting out over the ground before fizzling and fading out. At the same time, this passage is like the microscopically small film script to the shortest Western in movie history, a miniature screenplay for the only scene ever to be filmed from the perspective of the mounted native, the cavalier perspective, replicating the disorienting filmic effect of the tracking shot through the means of linguistic mimesis. First, the camera tracks over the neck of the galloping animal, then out over its head, zooming out into the distance over the endlessly sprawling prairie, a land that is nothing more than quivering ground, and, a little later, smooth-shorn heath. Kafka, like many artists of his time, is known for his repeated treatment of the phenomenon of speed. He was fascinated by Zeno's paradox about the impossibility of motion. Everything is in motion except one thing, the flying arrow. Rest is found only in the absolute motion liberated from all fiction. Does Kafka's piece, Longing to Be a Red Indian, also experience this paradoxical moment of rest? The longing is directed unmistakably at the desire to dispense with and throw off all riding tack, all accessories such as spurs and reins, to end up as pure movement, a vector, in empty space. Being a Red Indian, therefore, means eliminating all accoutrement to minimize friction, or even more than that, and more radically, dispensing with the horse itself, the physical medium of transport, to become entirely disembodied. Seen in this way, Kafka's miniature undertakes a journey of abstraction. With every phrase, the galloping steed throws off another civilizing element with which mankind has sought to dominate and steer the horse, first the spurs, then the reins. There's no mention of a saddle or of any stirrups. The items that Kafka dispenses with are the instruments of steering and spurring on, the bridle and the goad. These are the most visible, most acute instruments of domestication, domination as expressed in the possibility of inflicting pain and exercising control. Unlike any other animal in history, the horse has been girdled by a wreath of technical objects aimed at making it easier to exploit the beast, to drive and steer it in mankind's desired direction. All these items served the same purpose of incorporating the horse more intimately into our civilization, making the animal a significant element of our human world, turning it into what was, for a very long time, our most important source of energy. This history disintegrates before our eyes under the power of Kafka's pen. Just a few more hoofbeats, and it will be gone forever. There were no spurs, there were no reins. As the instruments of domination fall away, so there emerges the negative arrow of motion, pure, absolute, abstract. Kafka's Longing to Be a Red Indian gallops away, leaving the realm of history in its wake. Every civilization of the past headed in the opposite direction, with their tools and tack, their reins and spurs. They domesticated this wild conveyor of animal energy and perfected the use or transformation of its energy. It is not the act of dispensing with spurs and reins that releases the positive arrow of energy, but its systematic application. All the way it is coupled, or networked with other instruments, carts, harnesses, roads, etc. Technical innovations have led to improvements in the man-horse system's energy efficiency and its steerability. Kafka's Red Indian, however, traverses this one-way street in the opposite direction, his arrow pointing into the civilizational void. Discarding the reins and spurs, the instruments of domination, the rider author establishes himself as the sovereign master. But this overthrow of a hegemony accomplished by the Native American, or which is being a Red Indian accomplishes for him, is not associated with a dramatic fall from a horse. Kafka's protagonist is not Saul of Damascus. He deserts his horse not by falling from it, but rather by leaving it under or behind him. He transcends it, releases himself and the horse into a condition of wildness. Kafka's longed-to-be Native American has abandoned the realm of history. What has been the object of history, if not to permeate and occupy land, to conquer territory, to annex soil into one's own dominion? He does not occupy the land and mark out his frontiers. He flies over the land without describing it or even referring to it. It's as though he does not even perceive it. He barely sees it. But he hears it. The rhythmic pounding of the horse's hooves that set the ground quivering. The earth is the rider's echo chamber, a tautly skinned drum, and on it, the hooves beat out their dry rhythm of the Wild West. The rider does not stop to describe the ground, to occupy it. No. He merely grazes it with the drumsticks of the horse's hooves, conjuring up sound. Hegel's mechanical light, the thud of hooffall on the prairie or the smooth-shorn heath. There is no text. There are no signs, no territory, no history, no space. There is only the rhythmic knocking and bumping on the drumhead of the prairie, and the whir of the arrow accelerating from the bowstring. Kafka's protagonist does not make history. He does not make anything, in the strictest sense, but he evokes something. Something dormant in the earth, in the hooves, and in the air. The possibility that matter can tremble, can quiver, can be knocked, banged, rubbed, and given sound. The possibility of the sound and the vibration. He is not creating history. It is physics that he summons up. Creating resonance in the earth, friction in the air, sound waves all around. Wide open space. In the 1840s, the Munich landscape artist Karl Rottmann produced a series of 23 paintings of Greece for Ludwig I of Bavaria, scenes of historical sites he had visited and sketched during a long tour of the country. One of these paintings, perhaps the most famous, shows the plain at Marathon, over which a violent thunderstorm is brewing, an unmistakable reference to the fateful battle of the Athenians and the Plataeans against the army of the Persians, led by Darius I. Rather less usually, in terms of symbolic meteorology, the artist included another, this time four-legged, historical icon. In the center of the large canvas, which hangs in Munich's Neue Pinakothek Art Gallery, see Plate 17, we see a riderless horse crossing the plain at breakneck speed, dragging a red cloth fluttering behind it. The source for this detail may well have been the esteemed Greek tour guide, Pausanias, who reported the nightly echo on the one-time battlefield of the battle cry and the neighing of horses. Herodotus, the chief source for the Battle of Marathon, on the other hand, says nothing of horses and cavalry. But since the legendary runner who sacrificed himself for the sake of his victory message was an apocryphal addition from a later period, so too might the riderless galloping steed be granted its lofty poetic truth as a historical beacon. Given emphasis by the signal color of the cloth, the horse motif provides a concise, pithy encapsulation of the sum of historical violence that exploded at this location. The horse, as a dynamic symbol, a vector as swift as an arrow, turns his open space into a specific location, the open plains into the field of battle where, on a late summer's day, in 490 BCE, the West was saved. Franz Kafka, Karl Rottmann, Karl von Clausewitz. There are not many artists and writers we can rely on for a dynamic conception of space. Most philosophical, political, and sociological theories of space are devoid of that genuine human or non-human vector that crosses the space and opens it up. Space, much encumbered since academia's spatial turn in recent decades, an approach to scholarship that considers place and space in social science and the humanities, is generally presented as a kind of stable, pre-existing vessel in which movements can be registered. Only a few authors have recognized that a space is not present until there is motion within it. Indeed, it is only constituted by the action carried out within it. It is from this motion that spatial relationships develop. It is the battle that creates the battlefield. Just as the sailor creates the headland, the rider the bridleway, the climber the ascent, the pedestrians the pedestrian zone. A space results not from the static juxtaposition of various items, but from the movement that brings these various elements into a relationship with one another. A space exists, writes Michel Certeau, when one takes into consideration vectors of direction, velocities, and time variables. Thus, space is composed of intersections of mobile elements. In short, space is a practiced place. We fail to recognize movement by considering it in a spatial and segmented way. That is the thrust of Henri Bergson's critique of metaphysics. Kant's transcendental aesthetics sees space as a ready-made form of our perceptive faculty. Like a deus ex machina, no one quite knows where it comes from. Bergson also sees Kant as attributing to space an existence that is independent of its contents. In other words, according to Bergson, Kant is closer to the generally accepted perspective than his adherents claim, and thinks of space as a vessel. Bergson sends his readers back to the school of phenomena, to learn how to think of space as arising from movement, and to conceive of it in relation to duration of time. In this sense, Zeno's paradox of the flying arrow is rejected as meaningless, based as it is, on the false premise that an ongoing movement consists of a series of infinitesimal moments of rest, while the flight of the arrow is in fact a continuum. Suppose an elastic stretched from A to B. Could you divide its extension? The course of the arrow is this very extension. It is equally simple and equally undivided. It is a single and unique bond. If one wished to carry Bergson's theories over to the spatial realm of history, one need only follow the horse's hoofprints. To see history from the horse's perspective means to conceive of it as a mover, as a vector. As Rotman exemplifies in his Marathon Landscape, it is only the galloping horse that enables the viewer to see the plain as an historical space, a sphere of combat, of remembrance. Conceiving of history in a vectorial sense does not mean it must be understood as being unidirectional, like the arrow of time or a one-way street. Space, as de Certeau asserted, is made up of intersections of movable elements. It is, in a sense, actuated by the ensemble of movements deployed within it. The space of history, or rather, the spaces of history, arise out of a diversity of human, animal, and technological movements. Concrete movements at various tempos, from the lightning quick to the apparent non-movement of the sclerotic. Even a ship, bound by ice, is in motion, because the elements are still at work, the wind, the frost, and the wood. The horse, according to the Arabs, is a creature of the wind. It can help us to perceive movements in space and to understand things from the perspective of that movement. The vector may be a mounted messenger, a lone hunter, or an entire army. Its movement makes the land it crosses tangible and recognizable. L'anime, conquest or land grab, a term Carl Schmitt places at the center of his geopolitical theory, appropriation, distribution, production, or in more prosaic terms, grab, divide, graze, is a legal term to describe the successive acts of taking possession of territory. If we were to put it to the test for historical veracity, it would quickly become apparent that such an appropriation would never be practically possible without horses, other than in parts of the Orient, where Bactrian camels and dromedaries take the place of the equidae family. Before the conqueror can go from appropriation to distribution and eventually to production, that is, from seizing land to sharing it out and finally turning it to pasture, he must first have traversed the territory, that is, ridden through and secured it. If appropriation is to lead to genuine retention and administration of the land, then surveying and mapping must be followed by the implementation of a network of communication channels and inspection points, paths, roads, fortifications, depots, customs offices, post offices. The operation of such a network again relies on the availability of animal vectors, messenger and post horses, remounts, draft animals, in sufficient numbers and adequate distribution. In the example of the Spanish conquista of America, these procedures can be seen as prototypical. "It is possible to imagine the conquistador without his pig," writes Alfred W. Crosby, Jr. "But who can imagine him without his horse? Initially a primary instrument of military conquest, appropriation, the horse later became indispensable in terms of control of the land and guaranteeing its exploitation, distribution, production. The conquistador would never have been able to keep the vast, sullen Indian populations under control if the horse had not enabled him to transfer information, orders, and soldiers from one point to another swiftly. The horse made possible the great cattle industry of colonial America, which, in a final analysis, affected much larger areas of the New World than did any other European endeavor in that period. A swineherd can operate effectively on foot. A vaquero, or cowboy, needs a horse." Another historical example, that of Southwest Africa in the 19th century, was recently a hot topic in German-language human-animal studies. The evolution of political power by means of territorial control has proved to be linked to the presence and use of horses in Africa too, a continent not usually at the heart of equine history. Horses were instrumental not only in establishing and securing power structures, but also in expanding the territory of acts of violence, such as armed raids and cattle theft. In this sense, as Felix Schurmann was able to demonstrate, horses genuinely did radically change the conditions and possibilities of domination and its spatial spread, as well as the character of violent confrontations. The most spectacular acts of conquest in recent times, however, were seen in the Midwest of the United States. The Oklahoma Land Rush, or Land Run, of 1889, and the pursuant runs of 1893 to 1906, saw tens of thousands of settlers pour into the state of Oklahoma, originally designated as native territory. One run that enjoyed particular fame, or infamy, was the first land run on Easter Monday, 22nd of April, 1889, not least because of the colorful reportage that accompanied this act of mass land appropriation, or perhaps land theft. The correspondents observing the event could not fail to notice how this land run was, in essence, indistinguishable from a gigantic horse race, as reported by William Willard Howard, later famous for documenting the plight of the Armenians, in his feature for Harper's Weekly. At the time fixed, thousands of hungry homeseekers were arranged in line along the border, ready to lash their horses into furious speed in the race for fertile spots in the beautiful land before them. One eyewitness to the second race of 1893 was even more receptive to the racecourse aspect of the land run. First in the line was a solid bank of horses. Some had riders, some were hitched to gigs, buckboards, carts, and wagons. But to the eye, there were only the 2 miles of tossing heads, shiny chests, and restless front legs of horses. The starting shot is fired, and they're off. That one thundering moment of horseflesh by the mile quivering in its first leap forward was a gift of the gods, and its like will never come again. Franz Kafka, who leads the protagonist of his first novel, America, The Man Who Disappeared, precisely to Oklahoma, must have known of the land runs. News of them was spreading like wildfire throughout the international daily newspapers at that time. Of course, instead of reproducing events in a realistic way, Kafka merged or blended images of the land rush with those of a real horse race, something he had seen in October 1909 when he and Max Brod paid a spellbinding visit to Longchamp Racecourse in the Bois de Boulogne, Paris. However, the aim of the Oklahoma land rush, the staking of a claim, seems to have interested Kafka less than the run towards it. One suspects, and his longing to be a Red Indian attests to this, that Kafka was less intrigued by the processes of territorialization than in the opposite, becoming landless, free of the land, becoming the arrow and the native. Perhaps he is therefore only partially useful as a companion for historians, for the latter must, of course, take as much interest in taking, doing, and having as they do in giving away, shedding, and leaving behind, and in the catastrophic impact that the loss of their land spelled out for the Native Americans. An animal and a rope. An old man sat at the table and drank his cool, fresh wine. So begins the legend of the Giants of Castle Nidic in the 19th century poem by Adelbert von Chamisso. This relaxing evening drink comes to an abrupt end when the giant's daughter comes home from playing amidst the humans down on the plains of Alsace. When he sees what his daughter has brought home wrapped in her handkerchief, the lord of the castle is not amused. The child has plucked a farmer from his field, together with his plough and horses, and brought them home in her hanky. But farmers and horses are not for picking, the old man reprimands her. The farmer's no plaything. What were you thinking? The giants of theory might also have found the young girl's behavior a little disconcerting. None of them would have come up with the idea of laying the entire agricultural network out on their desk. Realism is fine, but please, only as a principle. The reason for this was the usual professional distortions in the division of labor. Anthropologists see the man, historians see the farmer, technologists see the plow, and perhaps someone will even be interested in the harness, whereas nobody feels responsible for the horse. Ernst Bloch once remarked that an anthropology that focused only on people did not go far enough. But this design feature, or should we say this structural defect, forms the basis of most writing on history. It puts man at the center and isolates him from his animate and inanimate teammates and opponents in nature. How else to explain the fact that it has overlooked man's chief zoological partner in the business that philosophers like to call the making of history? So far, the exceptions to the rule of widespread hippophobia among historians, sociologists, and anthropologists are rare. Some examples include historians of technology, such as Lynn White Jr., early modern period specialists, such as Peter Edwards, urban historians, such as Clay McShane and Joel Tarr, and military historians, like Jean-Marie Tempest. Global history, both in its earlier incarnation, Arnold J. Toynbee, and in its more recent, contemporary version, have thus far developed very little horse sense. In the era of global electrification, it used the metaphor of the conductibility of cultures and territories, Toynbee, while today, in the digital age, it speaks of the connectivity of cultures, Jürgen Osterhammel and Akira Irei. But all of these historians pay little attention to the central vector of every historical land power, the horse, the charge and the hardware of history. Even historians and theorists of communication, such as Harold A. Innes, who grew up on a farm in Ontario, Marshall McLuhan, and their followers, have tended to overlook, together with the human messenger, the most important envoy and courier of such messages. Similarly, the history of communications, sublimated to the history of speed, prefers to interpret in terms of networks and systems, which, of course, unlike Van Gogh's Tarasque on Diligence, Stagecoach, Plate 29, can get by perfectly well without horses, as if communications over large expanses could ever have been possible without fast and well-rested mounts, by regularly changing horses at posthouses. Weren't the numerous mounted messengers in Kafka's stories precisely this? Mounted messengers? But this die-hard anthropocentrism clings on. Even in the case of the newer, empirically-minded theory of history, informed by Bruno Latour's symmetrical anthropology, which calls for the inclusion of non-human actors, we rarely find the most historically significant among these non-human actors being given the slightest credit. Indeed, it seems as though even Latour himself, someone from whom equine history has so much to learn, prefers to speak of things when he means non-human actors, although they appear in his comments on clouds, gods, spirits, ancestors, and other beings, mostly left uncategorized and unnamed. Hailing from Burgundy, Latour was a child of rural France. Nevertheless, he was not a farmer's child who grew up with ploughs and draft horses, but a son of the vineyards. His interest was not in animal breeding, but the cultivation of yeasts and microbes. It was not the cavalry school at Saumur that caught his attention, but the laboratory of Pasteur. Nevertheless, Latour's symmetrical anthropology remains one of the best schools for the history of horses and mankind today. His teaching does indeed deal with the great divide in Western thought, and how this trend should be reversed. What he means by this is the total separation of humans and non-humans, which is accompanied by the radical distinction between relative cultures and what is perceived as a universal culture. But, argues Latour, the very notion of culture is an artifact created by bracketing nature off. It is only when we calmly leave behind the artificial separation of the realm of culture, that which we understand as the domain of signs and meanings, from the realm of nature, the domain of beings and matter, and recognize that reality is always mixed, that we open the way up to a historically and ecologically informed anthropology, one that no longer describes people in isolation from the other beings with whom they interact and counteract. All nature's cultures are similar in that they simultaneously construct humans, divinities, and non-humans. None of them inhabits a world of signs or symbols arbitrarily imposed on an external nature known to us alone. None of them, and especially not our own, lives in a world of things. All of them sort out what will bear signs and what will not. If there is one thing we all do, it is surely that we construct both our human collectives and the non-humans that surround them. No one has ever heard of a collective that did not mobilize heaven and earth in its composition, along with bodies and souls, property and law, gods and ancestors, powers and beliefs, beasts and fictional beings. Such is the ancient anthropological matrix, the one we have never abandoned. The ancient anthropological matrix. This should not only include the other beings with whom humans interact, the gods, spirits, ancestors, animals, but also the tools, instruments and artifacts, the technological objects man uses to assert himself in the world and to stand up to the world, from the most basic combinations, such as an animal and a rope, through to the MRI scanner. Technology, wrote one of the most important students of Marc Bloch and Marcel Mauss, the agronomist, linguist, ethnologist, André-Georges Haudricourt, is not a mechanical or physical science. It is a human science. It resonates like an echo in a remark made half a century later by Bruno Latour. The strange notion that society is formed only of human relations is a reflection of that other, no less strange notion, that technology consists entirely of non-human relationships. As Haudricourt puts it, a technical object, such as a vehicle, is the result of human work, and human work is an interaction of movements. In this respect, technology represents a system of traditional, that is, neither natural nor instinctive, muscular movements. To investigate a device in a technical respect, therefore, means locating within it a certain number of such systems, and then explaining how the object produced fulfills its practical function. A device is subject to two technical registers, a technology of making and one of usage. Before Haudricourt goes on to outline a typology of the combination of horse and carriage and its geographical distribution, he notes the two fundamental principles underlying the forms of transport involving horses and carts, namely soutien and déplacement, or carrying and traction, as pack animal or draft animal. The distinction applies not only to the connection between horse and carriage, but also to the connection between horse and rider. The horse carries the rider. It raises him above the ground, or similar, and it carries him away, that is to say, it transports him from here to there. By reducing things to first principles in this way, we take the initial step towards effectively overcoming the great divide of culture and nature, symbols and things. If we take the beginning of the history of horses, which is, in fact, nothing more than a historical anthropology, the history of humans expanded to include the history of the Equidae, where was its origin, if not in the moment when, for the first time, a simple connection was made between a human and two non-human actors? The two non-human actors in this case were a rope and a horse. The affair between Homo sapiens and the Equidae began at the moment when, for the first time, a human being placed a rope or a belt between a horse's soft lips, slotting it into that space between the teeth, in which gap rests the potential of another entire history. At this moment, a technical connection was made, the fundamental step that paved the way for countless other technical, political, symbolic, and emotional connections. In other words, a technical connection whose existence would form the basis for countless historical collectives, the Tour. And of all animal-human technical connections, it is surely the one that has most effectively pushed open the door to the realm of history, Spengler. In his obituary of the scholar, who died in August 1996, Antoine de Gaudemar wrote that it was with astonishing candor that Audicourt continued to ask himself during the course of his lifetime if it was not the other creatures who had essentially educated mankind, if it were not the horses that had taught man to run, the frogs that had taught him to jump, and the plants that had taught him patience. Certainly, very few thinkers had posed the question of the emergence and transmission of knowledge in such radical terms. Audicourt had managed to demonstrate the obligatory casual web that is spun from an invention such as the connection between an animal and a rope. One first practical application of being able to catch and tame an animal is hunting. Suddenly, man was equipped with a much faster, more effective, and more resourceful hunting partner. The second practical application was traction. If one can catch an animal and put it on a leash, it is not difficult to use it to pull something. Of course, prior to the use of animal traction, there existed virtually no object or land vehicle to be pulled. The history of harnessing animals is linked inseparably with the history of these vehicles and other objects pulled by draft animals. In other words, this knowledge spreads and evolves dynamically in networks of technologies and technical devices which are casually inspired by that original knowledge. And vice versa, seemingly elementary technical objects can only be used effectively in the context of the accompanying practical knowledge, handling instructions, as it were, as we see in Heidegger's analysis of the readiness to hand of a hammer in Being and Time. Indeed, the phenomena that we call things are in fact form-mediated syntheses of knowledge and matter, or knowledge networks with an object-like physical appearance. Out of the picture. Conspicuous by its absence. A joke from old Eastern Europe. A Jew comes out of the railway station, and a carter gives him a lift to the nearby shtetl. The road is steep, and after a while the driver climbs down and walks alongside his cart. Eventually, he even takes the Jew's suitcase down and starts carrying it. A short stretch later, he says to the passenger, "The hill is very steep, and my horse is old. It's hard for him. Would you mind walking for the last stretch?" The passenger dismounts and walks along beside the driver, deep in thought. Finally, he says, "I don't get it. I am here because I need to go to the shtetl. You are here because you, Nebich, want to earn some money. But why is the horse here? Why is the horse there?" Indeed, it may be that the passenger already fears the carter's next request. Might he have to pull the cart himself the rest of the way? With Beckett, this would be the next logical step. The sensitive carter's horse is present, and yet also eerily absent. A horse that is not carrying or pulling anything, that is just walking alongside. What is the point of that? Is it even a real horse? But the horse is not simply walking along. It is, after all, still drawing the cart. Its harness, its bridle, the cart. All that is still there. It is only its idiosyncratic purpose that has vanished into thin air. Its logistical function between the station and the shtetl. Its being a cart horse is lost somewhere along the way. Its meaning. Two helpless men follow a cart, in front of which walks a weary horse, and one of them carries a suitcase. In the late 19th century, the horse starts disappearing from paintings. Slowly at first and in installments, historical painting clings on tenaciously. First, it is just the tack that starts to disappear, the harness or the bridle. More than in other genres, this omission of physical objects is tangible. The images start to feel empty. Painting trains itself in the art of omission, in a way that has not been seen since Stubbs. And hot on its heels is photography. Daumier sets the ball rolling. His 1868 painting of Don Quixote, Plate 30, depicts the knight as a faceless figure on an old nag, which has a saddle but no reins. In one hand, he holds his shield like a pallet. In the other, he clutches a lance like a brush. How is he going to hold on to the horse as well? When, 40 years later, Picasso paints a boy leading a horse, Plate 28, he leaves out the elements which would indicate an act of leading. His horse has neither reins nor bridle, and yet the position of the boy's hand seems to suggest their presence. The lone Castor, or is it Pollux, still has the age-old stance of a man leading a horse in his desired direction. But the device, the technical instrument for steering, is omitted, and the viewer of the image experiences how his perception and stored cultural knowledge involuntarily replaces the missing part. We also find images where the horse itself is absent, but can be inferred from its attributes, like a historical casting mold. Things are only the limits of man, says Nietzsche, but things set a limit on domestic animals too. In the Tarascan Diligence, Stagecoach, painted by Vincent van Gogh in 1888, we find a stagecoach in the deserted midday heat of a southern French marketplace, Plate 29. The horses have been unharnessed, presumably led to a water trough by the driver or someone from the post house. They're out of view, but we still have a presentiment of their presence. We can feel it with all our senses. Their smell still lingers in the air. Their presence remains tangible as long as we can see the garland of limiting things that turn an animal without properties into an old coach horse. Then we come to photography, which flaunts its sovereignty in the art of omission. What might have become of the horse of the German Uhlan officer, who is being led to the French infantry as a prisoner of war, to Amiens prison? A lost, riderless animal with reins chafing? A bloated corpse with stiff legs and a blood-encrusted coat swarming with flies? Amidst the heavy tread of the poilus, the cavalryman prances lightly like a jockey in sleek boots. The slight injury to the head does not seem to trouble him. His gaze is bright, almost cheerful. For him, the war is over. The saber is gone from his side, all rank insignia perdu, tunic half open. He could almost be on his way out for an apéritif or a rendezvous. But no, he is the infantry's trophy in their triumphal procession. He has made their day. The infantry have caught their old mounted nemesis like a rabbit and are parading their booty through the streets. There's no horse anywhere to be seen, and yet the animal's presence is unmistakable. We can almost see the horse between the bowed legs of the rider. The form is clearly outlined in this hollow mold. The next photo, taken by Hans Namuth in 1936, is from the Spanish Civil War. A Republican brigade has entrenched itself by the Alcazar of Toledo. Behind a huge barricade of saddles, bits of cart, and wheels, a light infantry troop is in operation. One aims, another smokes. But where have they got all these saddles that they're using as a bullet trap? Where are the horses that are missing their saddles and have lost their carts? Are they tied up loosely around the next corner because they are useless when it comes to street combat? Or are they lying somewhere, with bloated bellies, dead in the sun, devoured by the catastrophe of one last unsuccessful cavalry charge? Are the militants in the picture dismounted cavalrymen, or are they irregulars who have plundered the arsenal next door? Again, the horse is the great absentee, inferred from the symbols of its erstwhile presence, from the relics of its tack. Even more telling is its tacit presence in the film still from a western. A lone ranger crosses the desert. The mountains loom in the background. Clouds gather above. The man drags his load pitifully, a bag or a saddle blanket in his left hand, a saddle and a bridle in his right. He was a cowboy until very recently. Where is his horse now? What can have become of him? Stolen? Run away? Killed? The lonely portrait is silent on the matter. This enhances the eloquence with which the absent friend, the missing mount, is brought into the game. The spur, the bit, the whip. More than any other animal, writes historian Reviel Netz, the horse was surrounded by human tools. And just as we once saw the insignia of a king in his riding regalia, so too can we infer from this tack the presence of its wearer and object, the horse. Now, it's the dismounted cowboy who has to haul it along, and is made a fool of in the process. A cultural artifact of equestrian accessories refined over centuries is reduced to a heap of scrap in his weighted-down arms. At the same time, the heap of scrap betrays his hope of finding another horse that would raise his status from the laughable pedestrian in the Hollywood desert to rise again as the king of the prairie. The horse in these examples is replaced by an ellipsis, a suggestion of an animal in the space left intentionally blank. The network is there. Only the central protagonist is missing. Omitted as a subject, the horse can be inferred from the margins, from the context of the objects that define it, be it saddles or a stagecoach. In other cases, the horse is present only in the form of an abstract proxy. This brings us to the hobby horse, a stick with a wooden horse's head, which served to provide the equestrian socialization of young boys until well into the 20th century. The repository of proxy steeds also includes the abstract horse's torso, a wooden barrel with a diameter corresponding to the girth of a fully grown riding horse, which, throughout the 19th century, furnished the studios of painters who specialized in equestrian portraits, a mount that now slumbers in the archives of historical museums. What might Goethe have had in mind when he acquired the tall, saddle-shaped writing stool for his Weimar garden house? Did he have such fond memories of composing verse while on horseback or on long carriage rides that he sought to recreate the riding posture, perhaps to summon poetic inspiration? One might indeed speculate that it was, not in vain, that Goethe ordered a custom-built, saddle-like pedestal for sitting at his tall writing desk in the summer house. This four-legged wooden stool with an upholstered seat was unmistakably a riding chair, on which, as Friedrich Justin Bertuch wrote, one would sit with legs astride as though on a saddle. To the modern-day spectator, Goethe's writing riding stool expresses a degree of abstraction that seems like a rather crude and yet insightful anticipation of Bauhaus furniture. The poet, as a tour guide through the German classics, writes the critic Walter Benjamin of a book by Max Kummerl, who had taught him how much time the writer spent on horseback. It's a sentence that remains a mystery until you see Goethe's riding stool. Another, historically later and indeed apocalyptic version of the proxy horse, is offered by Stanley Kubrick in Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, 1964. Shortly before the end of the film, the fatal B-52 bomber pilot, for whom there is no recall code, appears dressed as a Texan cowboy, waving his hat, riding his nuclear warhead into Armageddon. His horse, already on the way to becoming an arrow, a mere symbol, rematerializes again, briefly, in the shape of a missile. It is the hobby horse of the nuclear age, whose warhead is about to pulverize the Soviet Union, triggering the doomsday device. How durable is an entry in our collective memory? For how long after the end of the horse era will people be able to discern the contour of a horse in unprepossessing relics and references? What remains when the creeping amnesia of the virtual era deletes the traces of our former shared memory? An afterlife can be long, and the imaginary has a different viscosity to that of the real. But must it not have consequences for people's lives and their feelings when the most important non-human body, their former companion, in whom they have so long recognized themselves and misunderstood themselves, is no longer there? Their old friend, with whom they had been through thick and thin, who had comforted and rescued them, kicked and bitten them. Who in future would show these people what it means to have a body, a rhythm, and a world? This desire, writes Paul Virilio, for a foreign body following as it does the desire for the different body of heterosexuality, seems to me a major event on a number of points, comparable to the invention of fire, but an innovation that has been lost in the obscurity that surrounds animality. Dragging onwards. The journey to the shtetl drags on and on. The dry timber of the roughly built cart groans. The axles squeak. Two men trudge behind, sweating. Even the horse up front is exhausted, but it keeps plodding on, hauling its absurd fare. What else can it do? It's not as if it has its own travel plans these days, after all.